This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Like the kōkako, the saddleback, or te eke, belongs to the New Zealand wattlebird family, a family to which the huia belonged and which has been established in this country since ancient times, much longer than most of our other birds. The saddleback takes its name from the bright reddish saddle on its back, which according to legend is the mark of Maui's hand. Sadly, this attractive bird has disappeared from the main islands and exists only on a few offshore islands, carefully chosen locations for resettlement away from predators, which appears to have saved the te eke from total extinction.
Community or chaos? We can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Is the end nigh? We will ask Murray Grimwood shortly. Murray Grimwood's a Waitati farmer and commentator on environmental and energy and resource issues, and also on the crisis of the civilization. You can podcast this by going to oar.org.nz and then going to podcast and going to community or chaos. And at this point, the AIR Awards are coming up in the 22nd, I believe, of October? No. November, sorry. Anyway, the AIR Awards are coming up in November, and you can vote for your favorite OARFM program or podcast by going to OARFM, and then AIR Award should pop up. Thanks. And you just learned how many mistakes I can make when I'm reading from a poster for the first time. Anyway, welcome to Community or Chaos, Murray.
Hello. And thank you.
Murray, could you talk about the results of the local body elections, including the Otago Regional Council election?
I haven't actually looked minutely at them, but always this was going to be a problem that we have, that we don't tell the population what's ahead, what is inevitably ahead, and therefore the population vote for what is behind. In other words, continuation of the past, continuation of growth, whatever. And so you end up with short-termism in all respects. You end up with politicians promising short-term gains. You end up with people voting for short-term gains in their own hip pockets. And so I'm never really too worried or surprised about where things are going, except that generally you could say that there has been a right-wing lurch, not even lurch, just a general trend across the planet, and it's included at government level and at local government level, and that is a trend towards, I think, voters trying to regain the past. I think generally the average population are feeling that they're worse off than they were and that their children will have worse chances than that they did. And what those people are doing is trying to regain that past by voting for people who promise for it, and that is increasingly from the right. That said, I'm assuming that when the chips are down, leadership is mostly about wanting to do the best by the community, and if that leadership really has to pull together, I'm assuming in good-hearted fashion they will. They're just not leading us in the right direction because we're not going in the right direction.
I was actually a bit surprised about the local body elections. We'll miss some people, but the local body, the city council hasn't, I would guess it hasn't changed direction as much as I expected. I expected a lurch to the right. It may have had an inch to the right, but not a lurch.
Now, yeah, people often just vote for immediate change, so they throw the incumbent out rather than putting somebody in positively. That's become a trend right across the planet in first world countries this last 10, 15, 20 years. So it's a vote out, not a vote in, and we saw that with our major government last time, and we may see it next time.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah. With the present government is getting more and more unpopular.
Yes, and I think if they were voted out, so would the one after them. And I think it's...
But Labor also is not getting more popular.
No, but yeah, I suspect it's an unpopular vote out. And so what we saw was what I call sort of men in suits being voted out and some men in suits being voted back in. And I'm not sure that really there's going to be much difference at city council level.
For the last few decades, you've been saying modern civilization is in crisis. And particularly either a very fast shock breakdown of civilization or a more gradual breakdown of civilization. What led you to these conclusions and what are the drivers of the decline of modern civilization?
Well, if I'm predicting the end is nigh, and I've been doing it for 10 years, we've got to be 10 years closer to the end than we were. Basically, we're doing two things. We're chewing through the planet in resource terms, stuff we dig up, chew up, spit out, throw away, and dissipate. And particularly the energy resource terms. And those of us in my camp, I think the big learning curve we've gone through in the last 20 years is that fossil energy is irreplaceable. A lot of us championed renewables and thought we'd get there from here or here from there. But those of us who've gone that way can tell you that renewables don't do what fossil energy does, and society without fossil energy won't be like it was. Then we have to remember that fossil energy is about halfway through, we're halfway through the resource, and it is leaving us. So whether the collapse is gradual, whether the descent to an energy and throughput, resource throughput level that is maintainable is gradual, or whether some trigger takes us down in a screaming heap is a question. My feeling is that our financial system, which is based on growth, in fact, it can't operate without growth. You can't charge interest and profit without growth focusing. If that system, belief in it fails, if mass belief turns to mass disbelief, which could be overnight, then you could see a global 1929 Wall Street crash of epic proportions and unsavable. I think that because the forward bets made in money terms on this planet at the moment, I think exceed the planet's ability to supply the materials and energy. So, yeah.
One of the interesting things is that we have more sustainable ability now than we did. But we're seeing as we have more sustainable energy infrastructure, we're using energy faster than the
Jevons paradox. But it's not actually renewable. Again, those of us in my camp who talked about renewables 20 years ago, and I'm guilty of this, I wrote that we ought to be getting there, and I lived it myself, but they're not actually renewable. The accurate word is rebuildable, right? Dams, windmills, photovoltaic solar panels, they're not renewable, they're rebuildable. And what they require is, surprisingly enough, resources and energy. No dam has ever powered the building of a dam. No windmill has ever powered the rebuilding or replacement of a windmill, and no PV panel has or ever will produce more PV panels. So we have a question here about what is renewable.
I guess one of the problems is that if 20 years ago we'd really done much more in the way of renewable energy, we might have saved some of that oil and coal for rebuilding renewable energy.
If you look at the graphs of world energy consumption, yes, renewable energy in quotation marks has doubled and doubled again, and it looks really good on its own, until you stack it on top of the increase in use of fossil energy,
yeah,
which has increased at the same rate from a hugely far ahead starting point. And when you overlay the two, the so-called renewable increase is just a really, really thin icing on the top of a very, very big cake.
If we're, what kind of clock would you put on us then?
Oh, I don't see our current system going another 10 years. I see Trump as a, everybody fixates on the man, but Trump to me is a symptom, not a cause. You could remove the man, you haven't removed the root cause. And a look at Rust Belt America tells you what the cause is.
What kind of recession are we in, and will doubling our growth get us out of the recession and solve our problems?
Well, you have to define growth. Are you talking growth in throughput of materials, or are you talking growth in intellectual knowledge, which doesn't have a dollar figure, or are you talking in growth in dollars, which expect – dollars are an expectation that you're going to have material throughput to buy them, to spend them on. So if you're talking growth in material throughput and expectations thereof, no, I have no expectations that we'll get there.
Don't we – if, for instance, more people took trains instead of driving cars, wouldn't there be a kind of growth? Because when you bought a ticket to run a train, you're spending money.
No, it's a displacement of what you were doing before, and it's theoretically more energy-efficient displacement. And 20 years ago, or even probably 15 years ago, I was arguing that rail was a really important thing to keep and have. My investigations of what is truly sustainable in the long term, like intergenerationally, I'm almost certain won't include even rail. I think we're going to a lower level energy and material throughput. I don't think we're, quote, going back to the Stone Age, but I think we're going to have to live in a very less consumptive way. And consumption, part of it was, of course, shifting stuff around to consume, and which included rail and road. I'm not even sure we're going to go there.
Should we try to?
That's a very, very good question. If you have limited resources in terms of, well,
I mean, for instance, we have limited steel and so on, but we have a lot of cars that don't need to be used, and they're all made of steel.
Yes, but you've got to re-smelt it, and that takes energy. And it's all very well saying you can double your grid, but doubling your grid to do the smelting is and to take over transport. Doubling the grid requires a huge amount of material to be dug out of the earth, using fossil energy to do it.
Well, it seems to me it's a lot more sense of remelting steel than building aluminium. We don't even have the resources for aluminium in New Zealand.
Yes, aluminium is a very useful product. And bauxite is not the scarcest of resources. Aluminium also rematerializes very well and has a multitude of uses. I don't discard aluminium at all. But what are we trying to achieve? is the question, and for how many people is the other question. Because the two sides of sustainability in the long term are population and per head consumption. Less people you have, the wealthier you are in resource terms. So until you define numbers of people, there's a lady who I very much admire called Professor Ellen Mosley Thompson. She came and did a talk at the University Staff Club one night. And in the question time, somebody asked her, she said, how many people can the planet support? She grabbed the microphone and she said, that's not the question. She said, you tell me at what level of consumption you want to live, and then I'll tell you how many people can fit into the planet. And so until we've had this population and consumption discussion, planning for things like what we actually keep and discard in the way of infrastructure is a little putting the cart before the horse, if you'll pardon the pun.
The problem with that is, who's going to say we should reduce population quickly? I mean, we can reduce population by not having children, but reducing population by starvation or by other means, such as that's happening in Gaza, is not acceptable for humanity.
Well, not acceptable for humanity is a human concept. If you're going to breed yourselves to an overshot position, as our species has, then it may be that acceptable isn't a word that Mother Nature cares about much, and Mother Nature will just do what Mother Nature does. And
yes, but the choices, for instance, that are being made in Gaza are not natural choices, they're human choices. In that case.
Maybe. I would argue from an energy and resource point of view that food at the moment, for certainly the Western world, the first world, food is essentially a matter of us chewing our way through fossil fuel calories. Okay, energy can't be created. And so if your food energy, it's going into your mouth, the energy came from somewhere. Some of it came from the sun via plants and via animals that ate the plants. But a large percentage of the calories that you're eating at the moment, I can trace back to fossil energy, which is a finite resource. And if you stop applying fossil energy to agriculture as it's practiced in the Western world, you're not feeding the Western world anymore. It's as simple as that. You think about taking tractors away. You think about taking the Haber-Bosch fertilizer from natural gas process away. You start taking, by the time you've taken fossil fuels out of food calories, you're not feeding the Western world.
Well, what if we were eating like vegetarian Indians ate?
Yep, a lot better. A lot better, yes. And the most efficient way to get the solar energy, direct solar energy to you as food is the key to it. And the more indirect it is, and animals who have eaten plants is less direct than eating the plants directly. So, yes, the vegetarians are on the right track. Mind you, if there was only 100,000 people on the planet, it wouldn't matter.
Yes, but there are a lot more than that.
Ah, yes.
And I don't want to live in the kind of society that would purposely cut back on that.
No.
I would rather not live than do that, personally.
Right. We all make our calls and we all do what we have to do to live, and we all make our choices as to how many kids we have and all the rest of it. But ecologically and globally, the human species is overshot, and there will be a reconciliation of that one way or the other. It would be better to be voluntary than forced.
Well, that's, to a certain extent, that's happening, but not as fast as you'd like it.
Not so much as fast as I'd like it. I don't think it's fast enough to avoid Mother Nature stepping in. Yeah,
I mean, but countries like Italy, Spain, and most of Southeast Asia, the population is actually going down fairly fast.
Yes. Yep. Yep. I'm absolutely certain that the rainbow-hued community that we see erupting in the young people is actually a an instinctive or a subliminal reaction to the lack of need to reproduce our species. If you have a look at what all the rainbow hues have in common, it's non-reproduction of our species. And I think they're trying to make sense of themselves and their identities and their lives and their purpose, and other than reproduce the species manner. And I don't think that's been discussed, and I think it would be good if it was.
Well, that's an interesting concept, because something I've never thought. I hadn't entered my mind as why.
I think about all things. Yeah, I'm basically, I was looking for
But that's a choice not to have children. It's not a choice to do away with the people we already have.
No, no, no. I don't think anybody should be doing away with the people we have, but we have to land the population. You and I, everyone who's alive is going to die, right?
Yep.
All 8 billion who are presently on the planet will not be here pretty much by 2100. So you could, yeah, land that ship very easily by just stopping reproduction across the board. The problem is the time lag versus the resource drawdown. I think we're in trouble.
I think one of the issues here is there hasn't been any political or social leadership on this issue.
And probably the Pope gave us more
leadership than all the politicians.
Yes, it's not for lack of being hassled either. I hassle three genre really quite hard, and for many years I've hassled the media, I've hassled academia, and I've hassled politicians. Politicians can only be as good as what the voters know. So we're back really to the media and academia, and both of them peddle the growth neoliberal story pretty much. Both of them are part of it. And it's been a disappointment to me. The only people speaking up really are mavericks.
No. Would you like to talk about our current fundamentalist neoliberal theology in the context of the decline of civilization and our environmental and resource crisis? Is it partly a result of the resource climate?
Yes, and absolutely.
Many of the leaders, economic leaders of the world, like Musk, would be an example, extreme example, but an example. And he is one of the richest people in the world.
Well, on paper. Most of his riches are in shares, is in his own company, and if his company becomes nothing, then he's not rich at all. It's just numbers.
Go down.
Anyway, that aside, I think when there's not much in the way of resources and there's not much in the way of energy input into the system, then you get a few at the top and a whole lot struggling at the bottom, and that's what we saw right through medieval times and from before, from civilization start 10,000 years ago till we started into fossil fuels. After a bit of a boss versus worker hiatus in the 1800s, we got to the point where there were enough fossil fuels available, and we tapped into the oil in the Middle East. There was enough energy available, there was enough resources left on the planet that to sell the stuff that was being produced, you had to include the workers. And so for a short time there, we could all buy Model T Fords, and then we got refrigerators, and then we got televisions. And through after World War II, it was still pretty good until about the mid-70s and the oil crisis. At that point, there started to be not enough. And at that point, you start to see neoliberalism appearing, saying that growth is good, but really, and that the free market is good, but really aiming to advance the elite at the expense of the bottom end. And that process has gone on since Reagan and Thatcher and ever since.
It includes privatization of community
and
public resources.
Well, it's exactly what. There's a finite cake. And so for the elite to get richer versus everybody else, they have to take the cake. And that's exactly what we saw in the 80s in New Zealand, taking the public cake. And they're still doing it now. And they're still putting people like our current government in to nibble away at what's left of the cake.
I think you're, to some extent, underestimating ordinary people and democracy and unions. I don't think that we achieved democracy for the many in the West purely out of economic growth or the self-interest of the rich. I think you also achieved it because the ordinary people and unions and workers of all stripes demanded it.
Yes, but there was enough there for it to go round at that point. I don't think there is now, and I think...
But even in the late 19th century and early 20th century, the elite were willing to, in not so much in New Zealand, but in certainly in the Americas, including South America, but also America itself and the United States, they were willing to kill people in order to stop the unions from organizing. They were willing to plan a coup against Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah, but you've got to realize that they were talking about a world with 2 billion people in it, most of them who didn't drive cars or own materials, right? It's a different world. We've now, in the 70s, we had, what, coming up to 4 billion. And from 1980, when it hit 4 billion, we've doubled the population of the planet and doubled the per head consumption rate. It's something, it's exponential.
My argument isn't that we aren't in a financial crisis. I mean, a resource crisis, an environmental. My argument is that the ability of ordinary people to be heard when they organize themselves and to make a difference, you may be underestimating.
No, I think that what's happened is the workers, and I am old enough to remember all the hooters that went at 10 o'clock and 12 o'clock across Dunedin, and all these factory workers who went to work on their blue ovals or on their push bikes, you know, out through South Dunedin, I can remember them all. And the wee cottages that were around Hillside and around Ravensbourne. But those places, those operations have all been offshored to low-wage, low-environmental standard economies like China and others as China's risen. And we don't have the unions or the workers or the clout anymore. Now we've got a gig economy where people are working one or two or three part-time jobs to scrabble enough to pay their landlord. And that's a different world. When you're talking about there was a reasonable expectation that a person on an ordinary wage in an ordinary factory could earn enough to pay off a house in the suburbs and raise two or three kids, right? That was an expectation in the 50s, not unreasonable across the board. That isn't there now by some orders of magnitude.
Well, that's partially because of political decisions.
No, I mean,
for instance, when I first came to Whanganui, a lot of people didn't own cars, and they weren't terribly unhappy about it, but they had a lot of say over politics, and they could elect people like the Labour Party under Norman.
The Labour Party did represent, in effect, the labourers. The workers of the world, but we don't have that kind of worker anymore. We don't hear the hooters going off in all the factories. The Shacklocks, the Radiations, the Roslyn Mills, the Cadburys, they're all gone, right? And so,
but don't the people that work in shops and do jig work
No,
also?
that's not the same. It's not productive work. It's
That's true, but does it make them unable to vote or organize?
No, it doesn't. That's a fair comment, but...
I mean, the people that first organized the labor unions, people say that people don't have time to do that kind of thing anymore and they've got too many things to do. Well, in the turn of the 20th century, the turn of the 19th century, many of those people that were organized unions were working 12 and 16 hours a day. So it's not because they didn't... It's not because they had extra time, they had the will.
Yeah, they weren't on their phones either. Yeah, times have changed. But the problem now is that if you talk about those people who work in shops or in, let's call it service, in the service arena rather than productive arena, the vote from them is going to be continuing their jobs and therefore their income. And so the only vote that's going to produce you is economic growth, which translates into resource drawdown on a finite planet. And I have no way out of that conundrum except I can see that the system cannot keep growing, and so that at some point it will either crash or we'll go to war over what's left. What we haven't touched on, perhaps, is what we should do about all this. Do you want to go there?
Yes, let's go there.
Right. If there is going to be a readjustment of economic growth and resource consumption, it stands to reason that there will be two things. There will be a change in the skills required, and so I suspect there will be an awful lot more people going back into food production, local food production, very quickly, and there will be a lot more people per acre, and that a lot of the screen-steering jobs that we currently have in cities and city buildings will not be of value or demanded. And I think there'll be a lot of retraining required and a lot of local leadership required. And I think there'll be a lot of repurposing of existing stuff, and you mentioned cars before, repurposing of existing things to do whatever we need to do next. That's as far as I see it. It's just it's going to be a whole different world.
Where's the leadership for that come from?
I think it'll be not the leadership we know, which has been thrown up by the existing system. I think it's almost inevitably going to be somebody else who will appear at the point of, at the time and will fit the bill.
Will it be somebody or will it be a sector of society?
I'm guessing that if things collapse completely, then you've lost the internet and server farms and grids. Most people don't get their heads around this or even think about it. But the internet is only as good as the server farms that are fed by the grids. And in the state's case, I think that's like 43% coal-fired. You've got to be paying the people who are digging the coal. You've got to be paying the people who are maintaining the grid and the server farms and the nuclear power plants. All of that's got to be carrying on.
Is there a difference between email and the internet?
No, absolutely not.
I mean, does the internet you had in the 60s.
Can the internet.
How much energy did that use?
There wasn't really an internet in the 60s. We're talking.
Oh, say in the 70s.
90s, then. 90s even.
In the 70s and early 80s.
Look, the internet is capable of operating in fractional parts. And whether you can keep New Zealand going together, I don't know. But I'm guessing that the general malaise of that communication system.
Well, certainly Google and that kind of thing will go down because it uses a huge amount.
Yeah, but the biggest one is that we are used to buying stuff without checking out the person at the other end to make sure that they're going to supply what we've paid for. Right? What the internet does and banking does and all the system does is that it allows us to trust a system that will pay us for what we do and that it will give us what we pay for.
Yeah.
Now, if you take that system out, all of a sudden you're down to eyeball trust. You're down to having to see the person and decide whether you can trust them to supply or that they can trust you to supply them. And eyeball trust, that's not as big as Dunedin, right? You can't run a city the size of Dunedin on eyeball trust. And there's a thing called the Dunbar's number, which is theoretically 150 people. It's as many as you can remember with some empathy and decide on eyeball trust. I think it may be bigger than that, but that's the sort of limitation we might be looking at.
You had cities that worked very well before you had internet.
Yeah, but what we had was things like FOB. We had letters of credit, bank letters of credit, and we had bank guarantees and interbank guarantees, and that basically worked. That was a trading system that worked. You could, you know.
Well, why can't you rebuild that?
Why?
On a small level within, say, New Zealand, for instance.
Yes, you can obviously have some kind of annotation system, and that's why writing and numbers were first developed, was to keep control of particularly grain. So I'm absolutely certain that it will never stop accounting in some form.
I mean, I always say to people, if you got information or history you want to keep, don't just keep it on the internet. Put it on paper.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Or chisel it in a rock somewhere.
No, I'm being serious.
I'm absolutely serious too.
I mean, I don't think you can.
I'm an advocate of books that have information that I think is going to be needed in the future, everything from gardening to physics to soil to, you know, weather, anything scientific that we are going to need in the future. I'm absolutely an advocate that the books should be kept, not discarded and put on disk. I sigh when I see what the National Library and the Hocken are doing that way.
Why? That's a good question. Why don't they realize that?
Because they're part of this system, not part of the future. Everybody's ticking
away.
But
I realize it, and I don't have their training.
No, but their training is only to be a librarian in this system, and the new method of data logging is now electronic, and they're into it. That's what their job is. It doesn't entail saving stuff. That's something different. Yeah, how they go with archives when it's a first edition of a famous book, I'm not sure. I assume they think they're valuable and worth keeping. But nonetheless, we are throwing out a lot of information that I think we're going to regret having thrown.
I'm going to play a song now called Too Many. You say too many people. This song says too many millionaires. We're talking with Murray Grimwood about civilization, the declining resources we need to keep civilization running, and perhaps overpopulation, and where we're going from here. One of the things I've noticed about the economy when I was young used to be about making things, and now it's about symbolism, it's about finance, and it's not about making things, it's about numbers. And I think it's one of the things about the modern economists. The modern economists aren't about making things. They're not even about philosophy. They're about putting numbers together and saying that these are real and the only thing that matter are those numbers. Would you say that I'm far off on that?
No, you're absolutely right. If you look at the three people who've just been given the Nobel Economics Prize, although it's not actually a Nobel Prize, it's a bank-sponsored lookalike. But if you look at the three people who've been given that prize, they've think that economic growth has been driven by advances in technology, which have essentially obsoleted previous technology, and we keep churning and producing more and more and more. But I haven't read their full transcript yet, and I will before I comment properly, but I'm absolutely certain that nowhere in there will be any talk about resource depletion, scarcity, or recycling or repurposing, or the word called entropy, which is the trend from everything from order to chaos, which is one of your words. But the trend from order to chaos, and it's what you see with rust and corrosion and when a hot cup of coffee gets cold but doesn't reheat itself. Stemming that, everything breaks down, everything wears out, everything decays, and stemming that takes an awful lot of high quality energy and resources. So the more you have floating around in the way of materials, the more you've got to apply this energy to keeping the stuff going. None of that's in the economics model. None of it.
China, in some ways, is trying to create more alternative energy, but they're also as keen on economic growth as any other major country.
Yep, China's consumption is basically coal. Yes, I'm sure somebody in China knows that the way ahead doesn't include fossil energy.
Well, I'm sure there are plenty of people.
Yeah, but the problem is that you cannot run existing society, our type of modern society, what people in my circles are now beginning to call modernity. You can't run modernity without fossil energy. There's nothing as compact and as potable and as usable and as transportable, particularly as oil. And China will be better placed than the US, for instance, on the way down, having set itself up as well as it can, but it still will be in trouble. All those high-rise cities that it's built, I regard high-rise cities as uninhabitable beyond fossil energy.
I guess even Rome didn't have high-rise in the way we talk about it.
When you look at it, in terms of food per person, which is the baseline for us all, food per person is an acre per head equation.
That's one of the problems actually Rome did have. They had to get their food
back in, and it took
lots of ships and lots of people.
Well, and it took horses, and it took people to service the horses, and then it took paddocks to feed the horses. And before you know it, you're bringing it from too far, and it's either gone off or it's taken more energy than it returns you, in which case your society collapses.
Can you talk about – you mentioned Cuba in the past. Can you talk about Cuba and
– if we're looking to see what it might look ahead, nobody knows what the future will bring, you know. I mean, it might be a nuclear war and we're all gone in 5 minutes. But assuming a gentle descent through the energy system, Cuba is a good dummy run at what happens well led. So let's ignore the fact that we call them communist and all that nonsense. Let's just argue that they were
well. Actually, they're amazing because they had an economic boycott. They still have it from the largest neighbor, the largest country who's also a close neighbor, who's not only not only boycotting Cuba, but also telling all the people they influence.
Yeah, the biggest one was energy. The fossil energy that came in from Russia stopped coming in.
Yep.
And the way they dealt with that is nothing short of amazing. But
can you talk about that
a bit? Yeah, okay. Well, from memory, they did public transport very well. They've kept old cars going, and we've all seen the photos of 1959 DeSotos that somehow still run. But they went to sugarcane and ethanol, and they harvested solar energy, whether it be from food or directly as an energy source. They absolutely zeroed in on that. A lot of their city, it's quite funny considering just what happened at Queen's Gardens, where a guy planted some trees and was told to pull them. But every public space in their cities is absolutely covered in food. Food production just rows and rows of veggies. And yes, it was an autocratic and controlled environment. In fact, maybe that's the only way this can happen. But Cuba is well worth all the study you can do. Will it happen exactly like that? No, it depends on where you are. They have much better sunshine hours than we do. Probably better growing on average too than we do. But yes, it's worth a study.
If we carry on with neoliberalism in the face of falling resources, severe environmental restraint. Is this a shortcut to barbarism as predicted by Rosa Luxemburg?
I don't think so. I think it's a likely a trend. If you ask me what the States was at now, the United States, I would have said it was Germany in the mid-30s, 1934-5-6. So we're starting to see a trend to fascism and a trend away from democracy, a trend to remove democracy from people and fascist.
Fascist states not only remove democracy, they also have a history of, to some extent, ethnic cleansing and removing people, large amounts of people.
Yes, but I would argue that fascist states take over where democracies have failed to supply resources to people, and therefore there's competition, and therefore there's an us and a them set up. Competitions always define who the them is. And so ethnic cleansing is a result, an absolute repercussion of defining thems. And we're seeing it reversed at the moment, aren't we? We're seeing there's not enough land for the Palestinians and Israelis in the eastern end of the Med, so they're having a fight about it, and it's an us and a them fight. And it's the reverse of the us and them fight that was happening in the 1940s in Germany, ironically. Yeah, so I think these demarcations are all traceable to fighting over resources.
Well, how do you avoid?
Don't have enough people. Don't have too many people.
I know. I mean, how do we now avoid fascism?
That's the problem. Landing this ship from where we are, landing this aeroplane with $8 billion on it to a place which is probably $2 billion or less long term on the planet, landing that without repercussions, I have no idea how we're going to do that. And I don't think we are. I think we're going to fight our way down, sadly.
What should we try to do?
What should we try to do? Nurture senses of community and interrelationships, which the screen lifestyle is busy getting us further away from than we were. So if I look at people nowadays walking down the street, eye contact almost doesn't happen. They're almost all on their phones. In fact, if I stop at the lights and look at people in the cars around me, most of them are on their phones too. This is addictive, and it's taken away our personal interaction abilities and our abilities to read body language and nuance and communicate. Getting back to communities and communication and the era where people got together for common causes with like things like clubs, football clubs, sports clubs, you know.
Folk music clubs.
All those things. They thrive. And I think we need to get back to that kind of lifestyle. You know, I sigh looking at the number of people looking at screens, and I don't think it's a healthy way for society to go.
That's an interesting. Well, I think of the churches and religion, but also think of the folk club, because the folk club is one of the, especially their festivals, where generations get together and do things together.
Yeah, I think a lot of things like sports clubs, and I'm part of a few things. I'm part of one sport type club and a activity type club. And the only thing I noticed is that the people in them are aging, which means it's a dying thing. And I would regard that as a sad thing.
Well, that's one of the things I noticed in the Dunedin Folk Club, the people who attend on the evening are getting older. But the people that come into the festival, and some of the people that come in to perform, are younger.
That's good.
It's one of the, unlike most of the churches I've been interested in, it's one of the few social things that where the generations aren't fading as for the younger generation, and fading quite as fast, where
that's
they
good.
Still have a connection between generations.
Yeah, that's good. But we need a lot more of it. I think, yeah, that will be the need, is for a sense of community and belonging and making networks and connections.
Do you think when we have hard times, we can rebuild that? I mean, we're not always going to have cell phones.
I think they'll be in places where there's inspired leadership and they will thrive and take the ball and run. And there'll be places where there's chaotic leadership or leadership fights. I'm more worried about testosterone fights at the top end, you know, quasi-psychopathy. And some places will be badly led or not led. And I wouldn't like to live in them.
How do you produce, how would you encourage the kind of leadership?
Teaching A, the need for that leadership, and B, ways to lead, and also teaching ways to think. Now, most people think instinctively from their assumptions, and to learn to think logically, to learn to think in a systems manner, in other words, big picture and integrating all things, including feedback loops. And the logic path is things like and or, if then, you know.
I've been reading a lot of Andrett, Hannah Andrett.
Oh, yes.
She talks about these things quite early on.
Yep. There's a wonderful now dead lady called Donella Meadows, who's probably my favourite human being. And if you look her up on the net, ironically.
Okay. With that, we'll look up, say the name again.
Donella Meadows, and she was part of the Limits to Growth team. Yeah.
Thanks a lot for coming on.
Okay.
And you can podcast this by going to orfm.org.nz.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.